From Westside Church in Bend, Oregon, you're listening to Behind the Message. In this podcast, we take you behind what we teach here at Westside. I'm Ben Fleming.
And I'm Evan Earwicker. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Merry Christmas. Advent.
Advent. Yeah. What does Advent like technically mean?
Arrival.
Arrival.
I believe. Mm. You want to fact check that for me, Lindsay? I'm pretty sure it's arrival. Or coming? It's one of those two. I'm pretty sure. I could say a few more words just to ensure. Mm-hmm. When did you start saying Advent? Which is a weird question. We didn't say it growing up.
Yeah, I feel like it's been in the last, well, since Westside has like talked through Advent as the season. Mm-hmm. But that was, I don't know, 5 years ago? When did we start talking through Advent?
Maybe three.
Three years ago?
Yeah. It does indeed mean arrival or coming.
Bam.
Well done, Ben.
Nice.
You got them both.
Yeah. Real scholar.
I always attach the word Advent to adventure, which I think is cool.
Yeah. Advent calendar is the thing I attach it to. I attach it to those crappy little chocolates that are inside of the big paper Advent calendars.
Don't you dare call those crappy.
Dude, they're not good.
They are such a big hit in my household.
So really? The chocolates are?
As soon as Trader Joe's comes out with the Advent chocolate calendar, mm-hmm. we get them. We get two of them. And they sit there, and then my children just watch them. Just multiple times a week, like how many more days until... You would think that there was, I don't know, like gold coins in there.
Something on the line.
Yeah, but you're right. It's just milk chocolate.
Yeah.
But I love it.
It's kind of plasticky. Maybe we need to buy a better. I don't know if we've ever gotten them from Trader Joe's. Maybe that's the trick.
Yeah. Really? It's probably all
artisan
the same.
Come to the same place.
Are you guys Trader Joe's people?
Yeah. Not obsessive. There's a few things. The dips, Evan. I'm sure you're familiar with the dips. Fantastic artichoke dips, jalapeno dips.
Oh, yes.
Guacamole.
Sorry. I was thinking of, wasn't there a candy called dips where you had that nasty, bland stick that you would dip in the sugar?
Oh, my god.
That's what I was thinking of. It's not called dips.
It's not.
It's called Fun Dips.
Fun Dips. That's what I was thinking. I'm like, that
okay,
does not
well, I could talk
good.
About that too. I've never gotten it from Trader Joe's. I get that from Food for Less.
But yes, artichoke dips, the buffalo dip.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Oh my gosh. I could shop
there's
that.
There's a chicken artichoke mm-hmm. dip currently.
Really? And I know the buffalo chicken one.
This is artichoke and chicken. And a little, just a confession here. Alyssa bought a whole, you know, what a carton of, what is it? It comes in a tub.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll
tub. You didn't want to call it a tub.
She got a tub. She had a few chips with the dip and then she left it out on the counter and she went to run an errand. And by the time she had come back, I had finished off the tub.
Wow. I'm proud of you.
I know.
That was quite a confession.
It was.
I appreciate that.
So when you talk about Trader Joe's dips, mm-hmm. I'm actually
you are
very
familiar.
Well acquainted.
Yeah, buddy. It's so good. Yeah, Trader Joe's flours, dips, chips, those things, especially pancakes, makes for a fun Saturday morning, all this stuff. While we're digressing a little bit, favorite Christmas gift you've ever gotten? Do you have like a Red Ryder BB gun moment?
I have the opposite of that. So Mousetrap was the thing. This is 92 maybe. And there was this domino game where the dominoes would flip and then it would trap a mouse or something. I'm probably combining Domino Rally and Mousetrap. But anyway, it was something to the effect. It was probably a Domino Rally game. Mm-hmm. And I had snuck into my parents' closet where they kept the Christmas presents to see what my presents were. And I saw Domino Rally, got so excited. That was actually for my brother. What I was getting, and it wasn't the only thing I got, but what I was getting was a 101 Dalmatians poster.
Sweet.
And so...
The new live action one?
Well, 92, probably.
Oh, yeah. That might have been...
It was probably right.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's right around there.
The Glenn Close.
Yeah.
So Christmas rolls around.
That's rough, dude.
I watched my brother Ben open Domino Rally, which I thought was my gift. And then I get to open up 101 Dalmatians. Mm-hmm. And so disappointed.
I'm sorry. That's a tough day.
But what was your best gift?
I got a Sega Dreamcast once. That was, my parents did the thing where we opened everything. And I was being a really good boy and not being disappointed. And then my mom sent me out to the washer and dryer with the I don't know. She had a pile of rags and said, can you take these out there? And of course, the box is on the washer. Pretty special. I screamed and ran and screamed and ran.
it's a good way. Parents, like that. It's a good way. Disappointment, best gift ever. That's a good way to do it.
Yeah.
It's kind of mean, but it makes for a really it's good great. End of the day.
Yeah. And it's the Red Ryder BB gun thing. I prefer that. I've noticed my wife likes quantity. Mm. She likes a tree that's full of stuff. And I'm like, give me the Red Ryder BB gun. That's what I'm looking for. Just even if it's just one special over the top kind of a gift.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like it when people give me over the top things. That's all I'm trying to say.
Are you dropping hints for?
Yeah. There's no way my wife's listening to this right now. She's not a big podcast fan.
I appreciate that you said not a podcast. Like as in general, she doesn't listen to podcasts. Not that she wouldn't listen to this one.
Mine. Yeah.
Specifically.
Yeah. She's listened to Christmas music around the clock since her birthday in October.
That's amazing.
Arrival. What does this mean for the church calendar, right? We could talk about that real briefly. What does this mean to the tradition of church? Why is this one of the few things that we repeat regularly, do you think?
The cool part of a church calendar is the rhythm of it. And there's a tension in that, I think, right? Because things start to feel like they're on autopilot almost. And so I think our challenge, as pastors, leaders, preachers, whatever, but just as people of faith is how do we walk into yet another Christmas season and care about what this represents. And I think actually the rhythms of the church calendar help us find meaning without needing this like really moving emotional response to something. Something can have depth and resonance in our rhythm, and we don't have to be like, giddy about it or... So we can experience these deep things without needing this emotional response, which is confusing because Christmas is a lot about the nostalgia and the emotional response and the magic, right? And so we have a lot of things going all at once. And at the heart of this is really the heart of the gospel, which is God came close. Mm-hmm. And that's the mystery, right? Mm-hmm.
It is funny what it even does to talk church production. We can kind of go back and forth between... It's a huge celebration. It's a big night for churches, right? Like a lot of people come out to church on Christmas Eve, all that kind of stuff. And then this season, it's valuable. But we go back and forth between, let's make it a big deal because it is a big deal, right? And then the next meeting we could walk into and be like, let's just sing the hymns, the old Christmas hymns. Let's read the story. We don't even need to preach, right? And I kind of like the beauty of that. Tension of an incredible, it's once in a year, so it feels so valuable, but it is a timeless tradition that happens every single year, and it's old, it's very old. And to be able to walk into both of those things, I think is a huge part of the fun for a church. And I'm learning to embrace both sides of those things, and I hope the church is too, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we have this like crazy contrast with what we do at Christmas time and the nature of the first historical coming of Jesus, right? Which is marked by its humility and lowliness, right? I mean, that is the whole theme of Luke chapter 2, is you have this, family from the backwater and this lowly girl, Mary, betrothed to Joseph, and they're just nobodies, but they belong to the house of David. So here they go. And then he's born with no attention. And then these little glimpses of glory, little glimpses of the angels and the, eventually the wise men will come and find. But by and large, this is a very humble thing. And then we do like, we're going to, bring in a full orchestra and all the smoke and lights, And so it's this contrast of it. And I get it. But I don't know. I feel drawn to finding the smallness of what this represents in the middle of all the craziness of, church services and celebration and all that.
Yeah. Where do you stand on, for lack of a better term, like the idea of magic at this time? And you could use that word to mean just feeling moved or captivated. I see in my, my current stage of life, I feel like I see Christmas for what it really is and the marketing and the tradition and whatever. And then doggone it, if I don't turn onto Bond Street downtown and I see the twinkle lights in the trees in downtown Bend and go, this is beautiful. awful. Like, I really love this. It kind of catches you off guard, you know? And yeah. I think maybe that's what you're getting after, is the arrival of Jesus is something that catches the world off guard a little bit. And it is, there's a magic to it that I don't want to miss in its simplicity that should make us, it should move us, right? I think it should move us emotionally. I think it should move us to generosity. It should do a lot of things. And that's kind of the, I hope we never lose that, especially just as the church, that this is, it is, it's time to feel a little extra special, you know, not necessarily us and ourselves, but this story, it's time for this story to feel a little extra special. And I like that the lights go along with that. And I like that a little bit of pomp and circumstance goes along with it. We should be moved. And then, you know, it's tempting to sink back into cynicism and be like, look, this is just, we're just plugging away at the church calendar. Everybody relax. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess I never want to be against things that are well done and well thought out and beautiful and artistic. And that's all great. I think it's when it's the hollow, cheap versions of what we think is going to move people that becomes the problem. You know, when we talk about hype a lot and the downsides of hype, hype is terrible, but genuine enthusiasm and excitement and joy around the coming of God to us. I mean, all that's real. Mm-hmm. And we will use every tool at our disposal to bring about those feelings that are appropriate for such a monumental thing that we believe happened in, you know, time and space, and that we're here because of. And so, I think drawing a separation, because I think movements throughout history have pushed against this idea of, well, we're not going to have anything nice and we're not going to have anything pleasant in our lives and we're going to be the most austere people. And so we're going to dress, you know, in the worst clothes and the most uncomfortable things, and we're going to be as miserable as possible because that's what Jesus wants. Mm-hmm. And I reject that, right? And so how do we embrace humanity at its fullest and best and most deeply felt around these things without veering into like some cheap, you know, knockoff hype fest?
Yeah. What do you think is the defining factors, the difference between hype, not height, hype and depth? I think that's what you're talking about, right? It's not bad to be moved emotionally, to see something beautiful or be captured by a moment. Maybe it's the difference between watching It's a Wonderful Life and the Santa Claus 3. You know, one of them feels very prepackaged, formulaic, and riding on the coattails of something that was successful a while ago. And then the other feels like this big heartfelt. You know, both have a certain amount of success, both have a certain amount of fame, both involve some stars, but one certainly carries the pale when it comes to the poetry and the depth of life. Is that kind of it? And how do we separate those things?
Yeah, this is not just talking about Christmas, right? Like, how do we live lives of depth without being miserable people that no one wants to be around? You
know, like, dude, that's
how can we be? How can we be happy and not corny? How can we be, you know, enthusiastic and not annoying? We have to like wrestle with this, I think.
Totally.
Because if we leave it to itself, I think those, especially new in the faith, can come to the impression that, oh, like, to be a good Christian is to be peppy all the time. Well, that's not it, right? Like, there's a depth that brings joy that requires a long walk. It's the Eugene Peterson, you know, in the same direction. We're going to walk this way. And along the way, all the experiences of the human condition are going to come to us. Mm-hmm. And we're going to feel those deeply. And you walked a pilgrimage trail and kind of had your own journey of this, like, feeling things deeply when you're removed from, you know, other humans and things. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what you learned about depth.
Yeah, that's a good point. Exactly what you made, what you said. We have to wrestle with this idea. I experienced that on the walk and I wrestle with it all the time. For some reason, I got a hold of this idea at one point in my life that to be mature was to be very level. And when you win, you don't make much of a fuss about it. And when you lose, you don't cry and you move on. And I'm trying to break out of that now, as I think even if that were true, it's led to a degree of numbness for me of like, yeah, when you like me, I'm just not going to care because I'm pretty sure you're going to betray me later on down the road. It's kind of like the darkest version of it. And I think that's what the solitude opened up in me, was this opportunity where literally because of my geography, I could behave or talk or laugh or sing or cry or whatever without any expectation of what people would think of me. Or, and I'm not in very many environments where there's not somebody around, you know, or I got to go somewhere or get to something. And letting myself experience that in life was a really enriching thing that I've been trying to adapt into my regular life. But Christmas is such a good test and opportunity. I am such a gatekeeper for whatever reason, in a lot of ways. Naturally, you can't play Christmas music at X amount of time and you can't decorate. And this is what, I don't know where I get that. I don't know if anybody else has that. And I'm trying to embrace this almost mantra of like, we're going to celebrate and we should take this as an opportunity to feel whatever is on our heart. And for some of us, it's actually a deep sorrow in the middle of the holiday season, right? And for others, it is this really childlike thing that we should welcome ourselves the opportunity to enter into.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're getting to the point of, you know, what Isaiah prophesied, Emmanuel, God with us, is that he enters into those deep places with us. And prior to Jesus, in our tradition, you have a God who is holy and separate and apart from us, and rightfully so, you know, in our condition. And somehow, he enters into that condition and he feels all these things with us, and he feels that depth of sorrow, and he feels the heights of joy as we would and as we do. And I think that should give us permission to not put on anything, you know. I think there's a lot of maybe projecting around the holidays, or we feel pressure. We're around maybe family members that, you know, they knew us in a different season of life, and then it comes back, and so there's all these weird pressures, or we're hosting things and feel like we have to be on, and all this thing. And I think there is something about the advent of Christ that gives us permission to be fully us and feel met by God with us in the middle of that, right?
Yeah, that's really good. I like that. It's almost, I mean, maybe that makes sense why it's attached to the new year a bit. It almost feels like a new beginning, an opportunity to start again without all the walls and all the things that would separate you from experiencing this love of Christ, right? This that came in the form with such depth that it wasn't just a spoken word from the heavens. Instead, it was a deep physical connection, boots on the ground, Jesus.
Word became flesh, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And to embrace that whole idea in us, with us, is, I think that's the one of the most beautiful things about Advent, is it's such a vulnerable thing. To be with us is to be seen and known in every single kind of situation. It almost feels a bit like we are uncovered as humanity because, God's not just out there. He's not just looking down. He's with us, and there's a beautiful knowing each other and intimacy, and it's a little scary too, right? Yeah. And kind of all that excitement that God would love us in such a way.
Yeah. I love the comparison of John chapter 1, the famous, you know, word became flesh and dwelt among us, made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, full of grace and truth, all that. So beautiful. And then comparing that to 1 John 1, where he says, we are testifying of what we have seen and heard, what we have touched with our hands, I think is the phrasing he uses in there. And, you know, scholars debate whether that's the same John, but we'll say it is the same John. He's bringing this very ethereal concept of like the eternal God somehow becoming flesh and dwelling. And then in 1 John, he's saying, oh, by the way, we walked with him. Like we were there, we were in the room, you know, and what a beautiful, distilling of all the, you know, crazy power and majesty of God as everyone would have understood it into like the person in the room with us. And I think if we miss that, we actually miss the whole point, you know, and I hope in our teachings or preaching over the next few weeks, that really becomes clear of like, whatever you think of God as somewhere out there, this means he's closer than you think. Mm-hmm. This means he's more present in your trouble or your struggle or your pain. He's more present in that than you think he should be.
Yeah.
I think that's the point.
Yeah, I like that phrasing. He's more present than you think he should be. That kind of captures everything I was trying to say of the, it's intimate. It's almost a little too intimate. It's,
yeah.
It's known with depth. Oh, it's too deep, you know? And I think that's the beauty of the challenge of our relationship with God. And then with that, I like how Matthew presents the beginning of it by just going through a deep genealogy dive, which if you really look into it is such an illustration of the power of Jesus's arrival into a family. You mentioned funny family dynamics.
Yeah.
I do think one of the weirdest things around the holidays, especially this phenomenon is more prevalent, I think, in your mid-20s, where you feel like you're building this life and you're growing up, and then all of a sudden you're sleeping in the same bed you did when you were 12, and you're kind of getting talked to in the same way where nobody talks to you like that in your regular life. Anyway, that's a whole different podcast. But the family that Jesus is born into, with intention, right, has terrible and corrupt kings. It has judges that didn't tear down the high places. It has prostitutes. It has
right.
all kinds of people, successful and wealthy and poor and broken. And fascinating that Jesus would make this decision, that God would make this decision to not just come and to live, right? Or even to choose to be born of a woman is a choice, right? And to choose to be born in such a family with a complicated reputation, I think hopefully should open the doors for us to feel welcome into this as well. And that's the funny thing about some people's experience in church, rightfully so, is to feel like such an outsider, where of course, like you were saying earlier, Jesus born as an outsider into a complicated family should mean that we're all kind of on equal footing when it comes to this.
Yeah. And I'm reminded, like, even, you know, during his ministry in his 30s, rumors of, you know, his parentage were, that was hot gossip, right? Where he's pushing back actually when people are kind of to the side, out of the side of their mouth, saying, well, we don't even know who your dad is. And so those, you know, those rumors are, and so I think it should give comfort to anyone who's ever fell on the outside of religious circles of like, we have this model in Jesus born into a crazy family. You know, his own situation is fodder for gossip. He is not well received or respected in the existing established religious community. And from that place, he's bringing heaven to earth. I mean, what an invitation to anybody who's ever felt on the outside of things to take a second look, maybe.
Yeah. So what are we trying to accomplish, Evan, to give people a sneak peek through this series that we're doing? We're using The Anticipated Christ, a book by Brian Zahn, which is kind of a devotional, right?
Yeah.
It reads like a bit like a devotional. We're walking through that, of course, not day by day because we only preach once a week, but we're walking through the themes. And what are we trying to accomplish in walking through these different themes?
I think for me, and I'm curious how you approach this, I always feel the pressure of like, how are we going to, you know, change people's behavior immediately? Mm-hmm. How are they going to walk out on Sunday and be completely changed? When it comes to Advent, I feel like we have maybe more of a responsibility, maybe this is true all the time, more of a responsibility simply to bear witness to the beauty of what happened, and almost hold up this story of the advent of Christ. And of course, we're going to make some applications and points, and we do that. Yeah,
blah blah blah.
But I do think at the end of the day, our job as preachers of the gospel is actually just to announce the gospel, and at some level, say God, who you were far from, has now come close to you, and you didn't do anything to deserve that, but because of that, life is now possible again. I mean, just simply saying that and using the story to outline the plan of God to get to us. I mean, what else is there?
Yeah, that's really kind of a simplifying. Is that kind of what you mean? That's what it sounds like to me, is like,
yeah,
it's a really straightforward opportunity.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I think it's the foreword to Eugene. I'm using Eugene Peterson a lot today. I like him. The foreword to his biography, his son wrote the foreword, and in it, he ends the foreword talking about how he watched his dad his entire life preach the exact same message over and over again. And if people only knew what a fraud he was, because he never had anything original, he just preached the same exact message over and over and over, and he pulled the wool over everybody's eyes because he was preaching. He never changed.
That's fantastic.
The message. Yeah. And what a beautiful, you know, a beautiful testimony to, I think, when we get it right as preachers, mm-hmm. where we're not trying to be the cleverest, you know, blow your mind with, you know, I think some preachers are like, hey, check this out. Or, watch this. Like, come on.
How dare you attack me like that?
Yeah. But, man, at the end of our ministries, to look back and just like, yeah, I just had one message. Mm-hmm. God came close. That was it.
It's pretty special. Yeah, it's so my answer when you brought that up, my effort in these really traditional times is to try to make it as honest as possible. And I think we're talking about the same thing and using different language, but can we, with all the hustle and bustle and all the fun and the lights and the big, can we stop long enough to really pull back all of the extras and make this as honest and as simple as possible? Because it's good all by itself. Mm-hmm. The Christmas story doesn't need this incredible illustration or metaphor by Ben on a stage on a Sunday. It really is everything. It's poetry, it's metaphor, it's truth, it's history, it's honesty. And everything that Jesus did, if we can kind of get out of the way of it, I actually think the message is more powerful. And that was one of my, is it Scott Erickson, the painter, Scott the painter, who did that book called Honest Advent? Mm-hmm. And I think that was a real turning point when we walked through that book together, because his art is that, it's kind of that simplistic view. It's a very drawn back form of art, of painting. And, it really was a revelation for me of like, oh yeah, if you can actually just kind of put the elements out on the table and then take your hands off and walk away, that's how this works best. Mm. And the redemption that happens in the birth of Jesus Christ, it brings the story of Adam and Eve into perspective. It brings the story of an exiled nation into perspective. It brings the story of what's currently happening with a virgin woman giving birth to a son. And then it gives us that perspective. And I am pretty convinced that the more layers I put on top of it, the more I ruin it as a preacher. Because it is. It's just so good in and of itself.
And you're pointing to that tension, I think, that's there of, you know, honest Advent is messy Advent. The story's messy.
Yeah.
It's human. It's dirty. You know, like being born in a stable is not nearly as romantic as we make it out to be. And yet, you know, I think we also were saying in this podcast, like the magic is good. Mm-hmm. Like the beauty is a good thing. We're not trying to pull away from the beauty of it, but we also don't want to shy away from the honesty of what it is to be fully human following after God, you know? So like, how do we say yes to both? How do we say yes to like the stained glass vision of Christmas and also just be really honest about what it would have been like to be, you know, under the thumb of Rome, trying to figure out as a young woman, unmarried, having a child, what kind of stigma and pressure that put on, like all that. How do you do both at once, I guess? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and is that even your job as the preacher?
I don't know. Yeah, I have begun thinking about, and we'll see if I change my mind in the next 5 years, begun thinking about, what if I am just supposed to do this thing right now? And it's my temptation to be like, we've got to communicate this whole perfect thing that has this application point that can come after it. And I like to think of us doing that inside of a single sermon every single time, right? It's got this bow on it. And I begin to think about it in terms of like, well, what can we do in a year with people, or five, or a decade? You know, what can God do even more than that? Instead of having the pressure of this has got to be really buttoned up today, we're going to allow ourselves to feel this and to work through this and to pray through this. And that's great. And today that's going to look like the sorrow, or today that's going to look like the joy of the angels singing. And this year, maybe we walk through a piece of that instead of the whole.
What would the effect be? Can you imagine a church doing like a 5-year series on the Advent and just every the fourth summer that comes around and you're still talking about the angels singing to the shepherds?
Like, hey, Eugene Peterson's son said he said the same thing every Sunday. And we're just walking in his footsteps.
And then you realize there's no one in the room that you're not talking to anyone yet.
They're all gone. But I think, again, getting back to honesty, I think that actually does, it's a more honest way for people to take it in, because this Christmas, people will be walking through the death of their mother. And then three Christmases down the road, it's a Red Ryder BB gun Christmas, right? For their kid or for them or whatever. And I'm okay with that. I think it should be that. And so whatever people are pulling from that this Christmas, that I think really is a Holy Spirit thing, I just got to be really excited about and good with.
Yeah. I've never seen A Christmas Story.
Oh. How many times have I said Red Ryder BB gun?
I know. I'm aware.
I have not said Scooby-Doo, but I have said Red Ryder BB gun. Christmas Story? You too? Justin? Lindsay?
I fall asleep every time.
No.
I've never seen the ending.
Okay. Too slow.
You've never seen the ending, you guys.
I think so. Or I fell asleep and woke up at the ending, but I couldn't really tell you.
I've driven by the actual house.
What?
Where it was filmed.
And you haven't seen it?
No, I've seen
it. I'm just kidding. So A Christmas Story is great because I watched it as a kid. And Lindsay, maybe you've gotten enough of this and maybe you've heard, Evan. The whole story is told through the eyes of a kid. And so some things are so exaggerated and ridiculous because it's a kid's interpretation of the world around him at Christmas. And so I watched it as a kid, thinking of it as a very straightforward movie. And as an adult, I'm like, this is genius. And I get it. I get it more and more every single year.
Yeah,
and the highs and lows of Christmas, everything from bullies to BB guns. And it's a pretty great, you should check it out. But Muppet Christmas Carol might be my favorite.
It is really
of all
good.
Time.
It is really good.
It's so good.
Yeah. Michael Caine just playing it so straight and so good.
He's so good, man. He's the same in The Prestige as he is in A Muppet Christmas Carol.
Yeah. No, it's magic. Pure magic. And one of the better, you know, there's some Muppet films, even holiday films, that are not great.
Mm-hmm.
And that one just is leagues above.
Yeah.
Most of the others.
Yeah. There's like, they did a Pirates one. Treasure Island. Muppet
yeah,
Treasure
that was pretty
Island.
Good. That was pretty good.
And then Muppet Christmas Carol.
I think some of the ones were more made for TV, like TV movies and more specials. And you can tell the quality's not, you know, they don't have the big budgets.
Yeah. Are you a big Christmas movie fan?
More or less.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think that answers the question. Not really. Do you have a favorite?
Probably a favorite.
Tough question.
That is a tough question.
Yeah, like Elf.
I don't like Elf. Unpopular opinion. I don't like Elf. It's annoying to me.
Really?
I know. We're going to watch it with my family this week. I'll laugh along. I'll cry. I'll sing.
Will not.
Okay, so true or false? Does Will Ferrell have a house here in bed?
I've heard it's true. He's been cited, yes?
I've also heard it's true, but I've never seen him.
So the trick is to have friends in the coffee barista business, and then you find out who's in town, right? Which I feel like I'm losing those friends. They're aging out of the barista job or something. But I used to hear sightings of Rainn Wilson.
Uh-huh.
I heard there was a Michael Scott.
Fox.
No.
Oh, Matthew Fox.
No, Michael Scott from The Office.
Steve Carell?
Steve Carell.
He doesn't live here.
No,
maybe he was visiting.
I heard he
Rainn
was
Wilson.
Hanging with Rain. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Somebody even said they spotted him. How do I know this stuff? They spotted him on Phil's trail riding their riding bikes together.
Wow.
Yeah.
I know Rainn Wilson does have a house outside of Sisters. That's very verified.
Big Northwest guy.
But yeah, the Will Ferrell thing, I keep wondering if it's actually true or if it's just a rumor that got out of hand. I think I did verify. I saw something that mentioned he has a house here. But have people actually seen him at Thump?
Tetherow, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's supposed to be in Tetherow.
Yeah.
Well, Will, if you're listening, and I'm sure you are, Evan's not a big fan of Elf.
I may not be a fan of Elf, but if we could get Will Ferrell on Christmas Eve to read a story to the kids in his Elf costume.
Could you imagine?
That would blow people's minds.
So this is a great, let's do this to close. The history of West Side is that for a long time, Steve Mickle read the Christmas story.
Right.
He's not here anymore. Should we bring him back just to read the... I'm just kidding. We're not doing that.
It's not a live show. Who are you asking?
I don't even know.
You polling the room?
Justin right now, 541. Dude, what a... It's so funny because he has such a weird relationship with it. He was always like, this... And then he's so good at it.
Yeah.
And it's the best moment.
Yeah. So if for those who are new, you don't know, our former lead pastor, Steve Mickle, would famously read a story to kids on the stage every Christmas Eve. But then he would have to get up and then preach a Christmas message. So I think the fatigue of trying to do both and switching from like interacting with kids and being funny to like then preaching. And I think that was hard. Yeah, I think if he was just doing the reading, like he will be doing, starting this year, you know, it's going to be great.
But it's been, I've had people ask me like, are you guys going to do that? Or why didn't you do it last year? And I think a lot of it is because we're intimidated to try to fill those.
Yeah. We
shoes.
Don't want the comparison.
Yeah. So yeah. Stop asking us.
People compare us enough to Steve already. We don't need another way to fall short.
Oh, he's so good at that, man. And it's such a tough job.
Yeah.
Entertaining a huge group of adults while making kids laugh and making fun of the kids.
He connects really well with kids. I think at his heart, at the heart of Steve Mick, he is a big kid. Mm-hmm. He really is. Mm-hmm. And so even all the Star Wars stuff he has. I think he has three of those expensive lightsabers that you build at Disneyland.
Remote control R2-D2.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a guy. So that's, it's all coming together. That's Steve at Christmas, of course. Yeah. You get to be a little bit more of a kid. And then, oh my gosh. Which is why we got him a scooter a few Christmas Eves ago to rip around the church on.
Big kid. Christmas, I love it. That's really, I think everybody wants, you want that in your leaders. You want them to like, not be so self-serious that you can't relax. So one thing I wanted to hear from you about is we're doing a midnight Christmas Eve. We've never done this before. Mm-hmm. It might be crazy, but we're going to come back at 11:30. And I don't even know how many people are going to, like from our staff or the church, will want to come out for that. Mm-hmm. But I think you and I and
so
Lindsay,
excited.
We're pretty excited
we're
about this.
So excited.
I think it's going to be cool. It's going to be freezing, actually.
Yeah.
But what are your thoughts on some of these, like, I don't know, old school pieces of like a midnight Christmas service or midnight mass traditionally, bringing some of those elements in?
I want to do it because I want to be connected to a long history of Christianity at Advent. Mm. And it's funny, we're a Protestant church for sure, you know, and that means we don't necessarily have the long list of tradition just because of that, as opposed to the Catholic tradition. But I did find myself at a Catholic funeral a good handful of years ago, and this was kind of in the middle of a lot of the pandemic stuff. And a Catholic funeral, you do the thing that has been done at Catholic funerals, right? For a long, long, long time. And I found myself so moved by that.
Yeah.
I think there's something in all of us that's like, I want to be special and I want to stand out and I want to be remembered for X, Y, Z. And then in this moment, I was like, I want to fade away into the cloud of witnesses, actually. Like, I think there's a real beauty to that, that I'm not... sure, I'm my own person and Jesus sees me for who I am. And that's all great. But what an honor to be a part of this thing that's been going on for so long. And so that's kind of my long-winded version of this thing. Watching the clock turn over into the Christmas morning is such a time-honored tradition that means a lot to me now because of wanting to belong in that. So that's the biggest reason that the midnight thing when we... I guess we haven't talked about with huge depth why. Both of us are just very interested and kind of launched it right away.
That sounds cool. Let's do it. Yeah.
How about you?
I think similarly, being tied to something that goes back further than the last even 60 years, you know, so much of our current, what they would call ecclesiology or how we do church, really has been developed in very, very recent times. And if you go back 100 years, it bears no resemblance to how we gather now. Mm-hmm. And so if there are pieces that we can unearth and reconnect ourselves to that go back 700, 800, 900, 1200 years, mm-hmm. I think there's something really cool there, you know, that some people might go, oh, you know, what are we? Are we just universalists? We're just going to grab all these traditions from all these places? No, but we can be historically Christian. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We can be Christian. That is our tradition. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we've limited our menu of options to like, well, if it didn't get invented in the 1950s or newer, it's probably not good for your church. And let's reject that and say, hey, if it's historically Christian, there's plenty of wonky stuff in there, but there's some really good stuff.
Yeah.
And so we have this whole menu, 2,000 years of church tradition, and we can pull from any of it because it's our tradition. That's pretty cool.
And we don't have, I think everyone gets this feeling when you walk into something old, you know, a baseball fan walks into Fenway Park in Boston, you go, whoa, I can kind of feel the stories of the place. You walk into monasteries and churches in Europe, and we just went to Turkey and got to see Ephesus, and you feel the depth of the history, and it's meaningful to you to see the big empty amphitheaters that have been preserved over the last little while. It is meaningful. We don't have that in the Protestant church, really, you know, to some degree, but certainly, like you said, the last 60 years is kind of it.
Yeah, an evangelical world. Right, yeah, totally. For sure.
And we don't have ancient buildings and old things to tether us to this. The old thing for us is going to need to be a time of day, and it's going to need to be communion, and it's going to need to be a lot of these practices and these things in order to ground us to that. Because I think that's really the beauty of it, is it does. It grounds you into so many came before me, and Jesus was with them, and so many will come after me, and Jesus will be with them. And it's beautiful to feel insignificant in that way to me. I want those moments of feeling insignificant because of the grandeur of the story of God.
Yeah. And you walked through these places, Ephesus, Laodicea, places mentioned in the story at the very earliest points of Christianity. And not that there's these, you know, whole buildings still standing with functioning baptistries or anything, but to be in those spaces, that had to feel like something where you're connecting to the most ancient Christian expressions, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think even, you know, it's funny, you could take Christianity out of it, and just as a human being, all of us, I can see, oh my gosh, we've been trying. It captured me when I went to Greece, and I was like, we've been trying to understand God in, I think some of us have really, really failed along that way, and I think some of us have gotten closer than others. But then, yeah, especially as a Christian, to think about our traditions and look at the baptistries that have stairs going in one side and then stairs going out the other, right? To symbolize the walking in as the old person, walking out in a new direction as someone else. That is such a powerful thing. And to in Laodicea specifically, to walk through this old, gorgeous church where so much has been preserved, and to walk about 20 feet down, and there are markings in the ground from one of the first Christian churches that met in Laodicea, and they would mark the ground so that other Christians would know where to come and to meet and to gather. Those are powerful things. And to think, yeah, we've all been searching and trying to understand this, and this tradition has led us to thousands of years later to participating in the same thing is a cool thing. And this is a midnight service is just a small way.
Yeah.
To acknowledge that, but it's powerful.
And it maybe, in some way, it reminds us that we are in, you know, we are in community with something that is global. It's around the world. Mm-hmm. There are people that have literally nothing culturally in common with us, but we share this rich connection through Christ. Mm-hmm. I think that is the family that Christ came to create, right? And so it may seem like, 11:30, that's late, Christmas Eve. Why are you making me come out for that? Well, we're not making anybody come out for that. But somehow when we connect to some of these things that go back beyond our current tradition, we are acknowledging, like, we have friends that aren't just part of our denomination in our current moment in our generation. This thing is bigger than us, and maybe we're connecting to that through these, you know, simple things. But whether it's a Good Friday service or a midnight Christmas service, I want to swim in these older waters.
You, me, Lindsay, and 14 of our closest friends will love being there at 11:30. There are dozens of us.
Will we light the atrium? Or is it going to be like dark coming in?
Oh,
dark. You want it dark?
Dark, yeah. It'll yeah. Really dark.
Wait, the atrium will be dark?
No, outside. What are you asking?
No, I'm asking.
At 11:30, it'll be dark.
Should we keep the lights off in the building so they come in the dark?
Oh, no, I think that's creepy. And, like, people will fall down.
We could light candles. I just got stared at how I get stared at in some of our meetings where I have an idea and everyone goes, oh.
I feel like this is about to turn into a meeting, so we better close this out.
Oh, so good, man. The tradition of Advent is, it's awesome. It's a sweet, magical time of year for sure. And I hope we're all open to that.
Yeah. I'm glad we're all together experiencing this one Sunday at a time. Thanks for tuning in. We're at behindthemessage.com. And all of our sermons, of course, are at westsidechurch.org. We will have 5 Sunday services, not Sunday, excuse me, Christmas services on Christmas Eve, 12, 2, 4, 6, and 11:30. So hope you can make it out for one of those. We'll see you next week on Behind the Message.